Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, April 26, 2005. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and today we're holding public hearings on House Bill 5038, which relates to the budget for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adult, and Families. And we have a number of citizens who have signed up to testify today. I would like to begin with those that have come more than 100 miles, and the idea is we'll call three different people at a time to come up, and then we'll have about 3 minutes per person, and we wish it was whatever you want, except that to get through the list and to be fair for those that are at the other end of the list, we need to limit it to 3 minutes. And so if you have something that you want to say that's more than that, then please feel free to send us an email or a letter or a note. Give us anything in writing. We read everything that we get, and we take this very seriously. And we appreciate your time and want to respect that as well as, you know, as the committee members. You'll see that we're missing a few committee members. It's because there are a number of committees that are going on, and there's a lot of business and a lot of bills, and different members need to testify on their bills in different committees. And so we're just going to proceed, and I'll be here the whole time, and there'll be committee members that kind of come and go. So with that, I'd like to welcome up to the desk up front Wanda Paulus, Krister Holfelker, and Julie McFarlane. So if Wanda and Krister and Julie could come forward and have a seat, please. If you do have handouts that you want to have handout, then Sheila Baker is our able assistant, and she'll take those, get those passed out. Right. Are you Wanda?
Yes.
Wanda, would you begin, please?
Hi, my name is Wanda Paulus, and I'm the executive director for a domestic and sexual violence program in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And thank you, Chair Richardson, for bring me up so soon. Actually, I live 55 miles east of Klamath Falls, so I drove around 300 miles to come here in the last 2 days to bring voice to the issue at hand of the CFAA proposed cuts. I don't know how to describe more accurately what we do. As a rural director, I also am involved in responding to our emergency room calls, doing direct client services, answering the phone 24-hour crisis line at night, responding to the shelter and assisting there when needed. And so the best way to describe how your funds impact who we are and what we do as an agency in our community is a couple of examples that happened just in one day last week that we had. Last Thursday at 8:30 a.m., we received a call from law enforcement letting us know that they had an 80-year-old woman whose son had taken her motorhome, stole the title, and literally threw her out on Highway 97 at a truck stop that was about 17 miles from where we were, not quite 17 miles, but right there. And the truck stop had called. She was disoriented some, and he had abandoned her. So they called. The law enforcement picked her up and asked us if we could assist with helping her out. We brought her in to our shelter. We assisted her with filling out an elder abuse report, a police report. In the meantime, we connected her to agencies in the community that might assist her because of her age. She does not meet the criteria for services at this time based on the last biennium level of cuts. She's not a threat to herself. She's not a danger to herself. She just has nowhere to go. And she's a victim of violence from her son. So consequently, we are now housing her until the police report and the investigation can go forward and hold him more accountable for his choices. About 9:15 that morning.
I need to let you know, a three-minute limit is really short.
I only have a couple more, sir.
I know, but
one
we're already
more.
At 3 minutes. What would you like us to do?
What I'd like you to see is that what we have here is that your funding and the work that we do is multifaceted. The women that come to us come with mental health issues, those with disabilities, drug and alcohol issues, housing issues, and as more and more of these services are cut across the board in other areas of our communities, we are also feeling the impact of having to serve these women longer.
Okay.
And that is the bottom line. We're doing more work with less services across the board, not just in our own programs, but with other agencies as well.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry for the time limit, but it is just one of the things we have between 50 and 100 people probably before we're done.
My name's Kristen Hilfiger. I'm a Tier 4 medical foster parent from Multnomah County, and I'm here today with what will be seven of us foster parents, medical foster parents from Multnomah County. I handed out some letters from foster parents and also a copy of the Oregonian story from Sunday. And what I'm here to ask you to do is to not cut the projected 20% cut on personal care and special care rates. And all I can say is, you know, 179 of us medical homes, we need 1,000 to 1,200. We're doing everything we can to recruit and retain foster parents, but we haven't had any kind of an increase in rates for 10 years. 2 years ago, you cut 10% and only restored 7.5. I honestly don't believe that we can continue to deliver even minimal, much less quality foster care and recruit and get other foster parents and keep them if this cut goes through. And I would urge you strongly to show your support for foster parents and children in foster care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very direct. And I've been a foster parent, by the way. And
I know. I actually read about you in the paper.
Oh.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'm Angela Sherbo. I'm stepped up in Julie McFarlane's place. She and I and Lisa Kay are all attorneys. We represent children in foster care. We represent parents and foster parents at times. And among the three of us, we've probably done that for about 70 years, most of that on the backs of Ms. McFarlane and myself, at both of whom are also either currently or in the past foster parents. We want to commend the co-chairs for coming up with a proposed budget that in large part restores the proposed cuts to foster care and foster children. And there are three places in which the governor's budget would have had a devastating impact on kids. One is obviously the special rates. I've had a client in Ms. Hilfiger's home, and I can attest to the kind of care that they get. And the co-chairs has restored that, and we thank you. The TANF No Parent Household, which appears on its face to be a TANF cut, is actually a foster care cut in many respects because 89% of those no parent households are actually children placed by the state in foster care with relatives. The restoration of some of the caseload positions is obviously critical to maintaining the safety of children in foster care, as we've seen in the past tragic incidents. The one thing I would direct the committee's attention to is the system of care flex funds, which are partially restored by the co-chair's budget. Those are funds that have been available to DHS since 1996 as a result of a resolution of a threatened lawsuit. Those are funds that are locally distributed. They are not spent on administration. They're not spent on staff. They're spent to meet individual needs, and they have been studied by Portland State University since 1996, and the results of independent evaluations since that time have been consistently positive. They have resulted in earlier and safe return of children from foster care, shorter stays in foster care, and they've recently been shown to be positively associated with a number of the outcomes the federal government is auditing us on every several years, and those include both safety issues, attachment issues, and the well-being of children around things like their educational needs. So, again, I would commend the co-chair's budget to you with the slight caveat that if further restoration to the flex funds can be made, that would be to the advantage of children in foster care in the state.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's hundreds of programs in this whole system, this human services system, and we're trying to not only look at the big picture, but each individual as well. And so I don't know enough about that one, so I'll go back and look at that. Thank you. Julie McFarland, Julie Massa, and Denise Washington, please. Okay, I see. Get that. Mary Ashman, also step forward. Thank you. She did. Okay, that's it now. Okay. All right. Let's see. Would you like to lead?
Sure.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Julie Massa, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank, and I did testify yesterday as well on another issue. I work in the Portland Distribution Center and reside in Beaverton. I'm here today to ask that you neither cut nor cap temporary aid for domestic violence survivors. I've provided you with an informational sheet on TADVS, which outlines the program's importance and solidifies Oregon Food Bank's position on this matter. Prior to my work at Oregon Food Bank, I worked as a domestic violence advocate in three different states. I became familiar with the mainstream resources available for survivors, and I can tell you that Oregon's TADVS is a necessary program. The program has a profound impact on the lives of survivors and their children fleeing violence. And I would have not been eligible for TADVS. I'm a former survivor myself, and I worked my way out of the shelter on a minimum wage job. It took me 3 months to secure housing, which was a rented room where I slept on the floor until I could afford a mattress. And most shelters limit a survivor's stay to 1 month, with some exceptions. Survivors in shelter feel that the devastating time crunch to find housing soon is very difficult for them. TADVS is the key to that next step. Many domestic violence survivors and their children turn to Oregon Food Bank Network seeking emergency food assistance on the road to economic independence. Food stamps and emergency food sustain me in my first year out of shelter. On a weekly basis, I hear from many survivors with children who have frequented our emergency food box sites needing nutritious food for their children who have witnessed sometimes unspeakable violence. I always refer TANF-eligible survivors in unsafe situations to the Department of Human Services to apply for TADVS. There's always an audible sigh of relief from a survivor when I mention this resource. Please hold this program harmless, and I'd also want to say that I hope that you will also hold the funding for domestic violence programs harmless as well. I can say that I've worked in several of those programs, and I've watched the funding be cut incrementally over time, and I've just seen the devastating impact on the advocates that work so hard to try and serve these women, work over 40 hours a week, and just sacrifice so much to help people. So please hold that funding harmless, and TADVS is necessary relief for vulnerable Oregonians who seek economic independence. Thank you.
Thank you. Denise Washington, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again also, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. Currently, the Department of Human Services administers $1.1 million in funds for domestic violence programs in the state of Oregon. And then there's a separate fund of approximately $295,000 for the provision of sexual assault services. You know the important work that these programs do. You know they provide shelters. You know they provide the crisis lines. They provide immediate safety for survivors and their children. So what I'm asking today is that the CFAA funds for the criminal fines assessment account that is part of the public safety be restored and protected. This is a very small amount of money, but it has a large impact. The first speaker before you today was the director of a rural program in Klamath County, and she talked about the cuts that her funding, that her program has absorbed since 1999. And she talked about an 80-year-old woman that they're having difficulty finding services for. So I want you to put yourself in her position and think of the women and the children who are coming to you and ask yourselves, who would you not help? Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you. Ms. Ashman.
My name is Mary Ashman. I'm a medical foster parent from Multnomah County. Also, at the level of Kristen Hilfiger's, I'm a registered nurse caring for some of the state's most vulnerable children in my home. I have sent you emails already outlining some of the kids that I take care of, and as you may or may not know, my family was the subject of the article in the Oregonian this weekend, so there's lots of opportunity to know what kinds of children I take care of. Reimbursement for all aspects of foster care has historically been underfunded and often is one of the first things to be cut or is frequently cut. I can remember, and I haven't had the time to go back and resource while I'm caring for 9 children, the year that Bill Carey came to us and said that they were cutting our $5 an hour reimbursement for personal care to $4 and it would be reinstituted as soon as possible. And that has never happened. We have been cut and cut again. And we seem to never recoup the last cut before the next one comes on top of it. I care for and love some of the most vulnerable children in Oregon, and I have, for many years, been willing to subsidize from my own resources what needs are not being met. As I'm getting close to retirement age, I don't feel anymore that I can use up some of my family resources to continue to provide for these children. It will be a great loss for me to stop sooner than I had hoped. I have 2 children to finish raising who are 17 and 11 and plan to continue until they were raised, but I cannot continue to subsidize at any great rate the care of children in my care. I thank you for listening.
It would be a great loss to those children.
I feel that too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sybil Hebb, Hardy Myers. I didn't realize that Hardy Myers is here. I'm sorry for... I would have invited you to come up.
Morning, Chair Richardson, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Larry Young, who is the head of our Human Services section of our General Counsel Division.
Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to offer a few brief comments in support of the Policy Package 104 of the Department of Human Services that deals with Attorney General representation for child welfare cases. When a child is taken into custody in Oregon, federal and state law set in play a set of deadlines for the determination of whether that child will be found within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. And if the child is found within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, then there are time limits within which the permanent determination of the child's status must occur, either by way of return to family, adoption, accompanied by termination of parental rights, permanent foster care, some other disposition that is an alternative to the child simply languishing indefinitely in foster care, and that federal law was intended to stop that situation. That period of time between the jurisdictional determination and the ultimate placement decision is probably one of the most important sequences of decision-making in all of Oregon state government, and one of the most sensitive and important. And tragically, unfortunately, through time, it has also become one of the segments of state decision-making which is the most underserved in terms of legal assistance. The legislature has made a very commendable effort through the years, and certainly during my tenure, to provide the resources needed to meet the legal services needs of state government. Very commendable. But in the wake of the federal act that I mentioned, and the state law, the related state law, in the late 1990s, this area of decision-making by state government has become increasingly underserved in terms of its legal needs. And there is laced through that period of time, Chair Richardson and members, a complex of legal issues dealing with services, visitation, other matters, and then ultimately coming up to the whole issue of a decision of what direction will the state take with respect to the permanent placement of that child. Now, this package is a priority package of the Department of Human Services, which we strongly support, and the fact that it is a priority package, I think, reflects the urgent sense of the department as to the need to rectify that shortcoming in legal assistance for that phase of decision-making by the Department of Human Services. And it's not without reason that it was made a priority, and I think it certainly is not without reason that it was included in the governor's recommended budget, that he endorsed the priority status given to that proposal by the Department of Human Services, and with the full support, active support of the Department of Justice. So it's my very respectful hope, Chair Richardson and members, that you will ultimately decide to approve that package as another important step by the legislature, part of what, as I said earlier, is a very commendable record of attempting to ensure that state government has the legal assistance it needs in an incredible variety of activity that's engaged in, but none more sensitive, I think, than this particular one.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Richards.
If it would remain for a minute, ladies and gentlemen, this is a little bit different than normal in that we're taking public testimony, but the state attorney general is here in favor of a $4 million package to help assure that there is legal representation for children in the process. That's $4 million that won't go elsewhere. And so with everyone's patience, what I'd like to do would be to have the time limit not apply here so that we can ask some questions, because this is something that's pretty important. And so, committee members, I would open up for any questions that you might have.
Chair Richardson, if I might interject for just a moment, I had scheduled to be here during the entire committee hearing because I knew there were members of the public, and if you would prefer to proceed with members of the public, I'm quite content to wait and then return for a conversation with the subcommittee later.
Well, thank you. I think that this won't be too long. It'll just be a few minutes. One of the questions that I have is whether or not it's appropriate. First of all, why now? Why not before? What has changed that would require the expansion of these services now that wasn't necessary 2 years ago or 4 years ago? I mean, why is it coming up at this point?
Well, Chair Richardson, the the seeds of the need were planted with the federal act that I mentioned that set in place this
96?
This very rigorous regime of timelines for the permanent decision-making with respect to the child. And the state law followed that in terms of the 1999 session. So the growth of the need really dates back to the imposition of that regime on decision making with respect to the disposition of a child taken into custody by the state.
Okay.
If you go back 4 years, Chair Richardson, the need was beginning to grow. It has simply augmented biennium to biennium since then.
Okay. Practical matter, since we're dealing with states or areas of the state such as, Julie McFarland. Let's see, who was our first speaker was Wanda Palace. You know, she comes from east of Klamath, and we're talking about Department of Justice attorneys. Would it not be appropriate to have the DHS workers who feel like there's a need for legal assistance to be able to contract with a local attorney rather than have it be a DOJ attorney, because now we've got, you know, a kind of an access issue because you don't have DOJ attorneys from all over the state? I mean, would that be a solution that might even be more economical?
Chair Richardson, first, I would very seriously question whether it would be more economical. I think you would want to drill down into the numbers very carefully before you would make that conclusion. I would be quite confident in submitting it would not be more economical. And it would be the intention of the Departments of Human Services and of the Department of Justice, if this package and the counterpart Department of Justice budget package were approved, to utilize both the paralegal and the attorney staffing that would be involved to try to provide coverage on a very broad basis for that group of cases that these resources would be addressed to. The most complex of there will be a grouping of cases around the state that will be, I think, the most likely candidates for the Department of Human Services to wish to utilize these additional resources. But to the extent those cases will occur in Klamath County, I believe it's going to be the intention to serve them, alike with similar cases in other parts of the state, even more populated parts of the state.
So would you see having resident DOJ attorneys in Klamath County and Lake County and as well as other counties?
Chair Richardson, I don't think that the proposal contemplates that there would be resident attorneys in, let's say, Klamath County, but I do think that it contemplates that there would be resident attorneys as well as paralegals in Medford, for example, mm-hmm. so as to serve that portion of
regional,
the state.
Yeah. Regional.
And that they would operate from that particular location to serve, I think that Klamath County area would be part of the area that would be served from the Medford base, if you will.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Attorney General, I think this package, if I'm not incorrect, includes the loss of 44 positions on the DHS side of the scale, because we go from currently the risk factor that the DHS caseworker is providing, in a sense doing legal work, but now they're going to be replaced by an attorney, which I understand that piece of it. I just wonder, having not attended that type of hearing, will it be the case where the caseworker for that child would not still go to the hearing? I mean, would the attorney replace the caseworker in that case? Or
how will it change?
How will that change?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I'm going to have Mr. Young also answer in just a moment, if I may. But first, the position changes in the Department of Human Services, that is, the reduction in the number of actual caseworkers, is a reflection of the judgment by the department that if these legal resources become available, a huge amount of work that is presently being done by caseworkers can be shifted, of a legal nature, if you will, can be shifted away from them and instead concentrated on paralegals as well as the lawyers themselves, and that the gain, the liberation of, from those responsibilities permits the reduction in the number of caseworkers. And they have, I think, gone through a very careful assessment the effects of that shifting of responsibilities of a legal nature away from the caseworkers. Now, as to whether the caseworkers themselves would cease to be involved, let's say, in court proceedings, as far as I know, the answer is no, they would still be involved as they are, but I'll let Mr. Young verify that or correct me if I'm wrong.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, Larry Young with the Department of Justice. Caseworkers would still be involved in the hearings. The caseworkers are primarily responsible for providing social services to the children and to the parents that are involved with the Department of Human Services. What is happening is, on the DHS side, they are having a reduction in 42 positions, but they are replacing those 42 positions with, I believe it's approximately 49 paralegals. These paralegals will be stationed in DHA offices throughout the state, and they will be resident. There won't be necessarily a paralegal in every office, because it depends upon the population density of the particular counties, but they will be spread throughout the state. What a caseworker does now is a lot of work to assist the attorney and to assist the court in getting ready for and presenting juvenile case hearings in the courtroom. There are discovery requirements that various documents be presented to all of attorneys for all of the parties in the proceedings. Currently, caseworkers are primarily responsible for doing all of the discovery, going through the file, finding out what is necessary to copy and to disperse and that sort of thing. That work is going to be shifted over to paralegals who will be specially trained in the nuances of discovery and confidentiality law and the constitutional rights of parents and children, so that all of the proper discovery goes out and they will be directing that sort of discovery. So that will free the caseworker to spend more time either visiting the child or doing other casework that occurs in normal cases. obviously, the primary witness as to what is happening with the child will continue to be the caseworker. They will continue to go to the hearing. The paralegal will be assisting the attorney in preparing all of the paperwork and background that is necessary to present in a hearing.
Okay, my understanding is that we're talking about over $4 million from the CAP budget and about $2.5 million in your budget. Is that correct? So we're looking at about $6.5 million?
Chair Richardson, no, I don't believe, I believe the total package is $4.2 million.
That's in the CAP budget. Would you not be incurring...
The Department of Justice would bill for its services, so the funding is in the Department of Human Services budget and would flow to the department as other funds in response to billings rendered by the attorneys.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, the $4.8 million in the Children, Adults, and Families budget includes the about $2.5 million that would be paid to Department of Justice from general funds, and it's reflected as other funds in their budget.
Okay.
And there are 31 positions that are reclassified and 42 positions added. So there's a total of 70-some positions adjusted in this package, but the actual loss of caseworker positions is only about 31.
Okay. Representative Henson and then Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I've kind of learned through knocking around government for a while is it's always real smart to follow your attorney's advice, which in this case is the Attorney General. So when this is presented by two departments as a priority, I take it very, very seriously. And the reservations I have are, one, because of the cost, and we've got a zero-sum game where whatever we spend in this arena is dollars that aren't going to be spent either for case managers or direct services or some other part of the human services budget. The other concern is that the way it's been explained is that the child often is appointed both a CASA worker as well as a public defender to look out for the interests of the child. The parents often have public defender representation or private representation. Oftentimes the district attorney is involved in these cases because there's some ongoing local thing, plus the juvenile judge responsibility is to be looking out for the interests of the child. And then we hear that the department isn't represented, although there's a great deal, and certainly that would be true, that there's a great deal of representation available for the parties involved other than the department. But I don't know whether the department has a distinctly different set of interests than the interests of the child at stake. So I guess to help me on this decision, if I could get some analysis of some of the types of cases where the department's representation is lacking. The other, so far we pretty much generalize in terms when the Attorney General would be involved in, or the Department of Justice would be involved in what type of cases, and yet I haven't seen a lot of real examples, because I still understand it'll only be like 15%, probably Department of Justice representation in only maybe 15% of the cases. The other thing that is a little disappointing, and it's certainly not from the Department of Justice, but this issue of shifting the workload from caseworkers to paralegals, which I can certainly see that might be a more efficient way to deal with the issues you've just pointed out. But we still don't have the staffing study, and we probably won't have the staffing study that might be helpful in terms of pointing out how much work caseworkers, what percentage of time caseworkers are actually spending on doing legal type work that could be replaced by the paralegals. So I guess the one thing from you that I, or from the department, that I would appreciate would be some examples of the types of cases where it would really be helpful to have Department of Justice involvement, And what has been lacking on, what are some examples of problems that have occurred by not having involvement up until now? Because it's certainly a serious issue, and it's obviously it's important if for both departments to have brought it forward. The troubling part is just finding the money, and what don't we do if we spend the money in this arena? Thank you.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, we will be very pleased to try to provide you with that additional information and of the kind that you've detailed. And I might just add very quickly, Mr. Chair, if I might, in relation to the zero-sum aspect of this, you're absolutely right. And it is, of course, the Assembly's decision ultimately as to how you apply the resources that you have available. But again, though, I would respectfully assert that when the Department of Human Services itself, and ultimately with the approval of the governor, judges this particular allocation of resources to be worthy of approval as against other choices that might be made with respect to those particular funds, that obviously isn't dispositive for your decision, but I do commend it to you as one that deserves your very serious consideration, because I think that this has been an issue that has been augmenting, growing steadily, biennium to biennium, and I think the fact that it is in the governor's recommended budget at the instigation of the Department of Human Services is a reflection, indeed, of how seriously the Department of Human Services views this particular area of decision making and the deficiencies that exist with respect to legal assistance with the progress of that decision-making for this tremendously important decision respecting the children of our state.
There is no question. And as an attorney, I certainly understand what it means to practice without a law degree and that there's an issue there and that there's a lot at stake. But there must be, we're balancing, because at over $4 million, and what program ever stayed at the level that it started? And so what we really do is say, okay, where's it going to be in 2 years? And where from there on, and it does drain, you know, funds that can go elsewhere. And so we're just trying to seriously not only consider it, but try and analyze, you know, are there other ways that this could be done? I mean, at a lesser cost. Certainly the use of paralegals is an excellent, just like physician's assistants. I mean, every law firm that I know uses paralegals extensively now. They often know more than the lawyers do about their specific area, since a lawyer needs to know about all of it, and they're focused on one area. And so that certainly makes a lot of sense to use paralegals. Senator Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as I sit here, I have a kind of a different view. I sit and I look at our Attorney General, I have a great deal of respect for it. No, I see right behind him sitting Mary Ashman, I hope I've got your name correct, a registered nurse who has given up her life to do God's work. And she's telling us we're cutting her program, making her job more difficult. And you're telling us we've got to get this money over to you, but it's coming out of pockets like hers to do it. And that makes it very real for me when I look at this. Now, I want to step back for a minute and ask you what we're actually buying here. And I'm going to form that question, though, very carefully. The federal government has said that we need to move people faster, children faster, to the foster care system, either to permanency in their lives with adoption or back to their families. And I agree with that policy. That's a significant change in policy which has brought this question to the forefront. And I'm thinking that possibly this is not a zero-sum game. The pressure on our families in foster care is huge. It's growing with the meth abuse that was going on in the state and other problems we're facing. And if we can find a system that works more efficiently, makes that decision more carefully, makes the decision more quickly, is it not possible we'll be taking pressure off our foster care families from the point of view that we're moving children that can be adopted through that program and into adoptive homes faster or back to their families? There will be medically fragile children that, frankly, I don't think are going to be ever and significant numbers adopted. We'll have people like Mary working their entire lives to take care of these children. She has the expertise, the knowledge, and the heart to do this job. It would be a real burden for an adoptive family, and I'm afraid some of these children aren't going to be very adoptive. I may be wrong about that, and I hope I am. But having said that, can you tell us if you think this program is going to make the system more efficient and be better for children? If that's the case, then I feel that we're buying something that's worthwhile. If we're just putting in another layer of bureaucracy, another layer of legalese in the system, then I'm not convinced it's something we should do. I personally think at this time, unless you can convince me otherwise, that we probably should be doing this for the reasons I've outlined. But my question is, do you think it's going to make the system better? And how do we know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, that it has made the system better?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, from my perspective, the objectives here are, the most important objective is to permit caseworkers to concentrate on being caseworkers. That is the bottom line objective. But along with that, to ensure that as this tremendously important process of decision-making unfolds, that it unfolds at all stages in accordance with law, and that the ultimate decision that is made with respect to the child's placement is one that is informed, that is legally sound, and legally sound. That's from a public lawyer's perspective. But to me, as I say, the bottom line, the bottom line goal is to liberate caseworkers from the overlay that has fallen on them of the various legal kinds of obligations that attach to the process spawned by the federal and state laws, and thereby to permit a higher quality rendition of services by the caseworkers to the children, and for that matter, the families involved. Now, how you can quantify that, I'm not sure. But that, I think, from my perspective, Senator Bates, is the dominating goal here. I might ask, if you wouldn't mind, if Mr. Young would have anything to add to that. He probably would, because of his much longer experience with these cases.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I agree with Attorney General Myers' analysis of the package and what the primary purpose is. But there would also be advantages to having more attorneys involved. Oftentimes, members of the bar do not want to negotiate cases with caseworkers. They would prefer to go to court because they believe that they can get more out of the court than they can out of a negotiation. It's been my experience in supervising a number of attorneys with the department that if attorneys are involved, there tends to be more negotiation, and the result is that there tend to be settlements by which all parties agree as to the resolution of the case, oftentimes short of any actual hearing. We like settlements, and the reason we like settlements is because it means that the parents are typically buying into the solution and are becoming part of the solution as opposed to objecting to the state's involvement. Oftentimes there are deficiencies in parent skills, and that's why the children came into the custody of the court in the first place. If the parents are willing to work with the state and work on those things, it obviously goes better for the child. We are able to return the child home more quickly. Conversely, if we have a situation where the parents simply cannot parent and the case is ultimately going to end up as one where there's going to be a case for termination of parental rights and adoption of the child so that the child will achieve permanency in another way, what happens now if there's been no legal involvement is the first thing that the attorneys that are doing the termination of parental rights have to do is look back to see if all of the requirements of the law have been complied with and if the parents have been given reasonable and adequate chances to improve their performance with an eye as to the legal requirements. And we find that all too often that hasn't been done, and what has to happen is that we put the case on hold for a few months while additional services are offered to the children. That or to the parents. That doesn't help get the child to the permanent situation in a speedy and efficient manner. I mean, what's important for the child is to know what their life situation is going to be. So by having more attorney involvement, particularly in contentious cases, we can speed that process along and make sure that the parents are given a full and fair chance.
Okay. Mr. Chair. I appreciate your testimony and help. I've heard a good deal of that before, but not all of it. I will still go back to my major precept, which is what happens to that child? Are we getting these children through the system more efficiently this way, more fairly for the parents and for the child both? I think this change probably would do that, and ultimately that should lead us to a situation where we actually have more funds available for programs like Mary's, because we will not be in a situation where we have children languishing in foster care while a decision is made. I think that's what the federal government is trying to tell us to do. I think it's what we're trying to do here. I just need to hear more, I think, about the long-term effects of this change. And maybe that really should come not from the Attorney General, but from the head of the agency and the people who work directly with these programs more. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know that in 2 or 3 years they could say to us, this has been the effect. We have a lesser number of children in foster care, more adoptive care, more back with their homes. Those kind of changes being made. I don't know if that will happen or not.
I'd like to hear from one or two of not the director of the agency, because that's the party line. But what I hear is from a couple of caseworkers who are doing this to discuss what it means. The most significant thing that I heard today is that there are procedures that are not being clearly met that end up having to be met before there's a termination, and now it delays things for a couple of months as they go back to make sure that everything has been done that could have been processed had it been, you know, being watched from someone who was trained legally.
Probably the caseworkers, the director of the courts, are the ones that give us the best picture of this.
Yeah, you know, I think I'd also like to, and I may make a phone call and talk to an attorney or two who does this kind of work, because it's been said twice now that it's a chilling from negotiations. Well, if I were an attorney, I wouldn't hesitate to negotiate with the DHS worker and the other attorneys. I mean, what does it matter to me whether it's a lawyer for DHS or a DHS worker? They still represent the organization, and the goal is to get conclusion. But maybe that's not the case, but we can find that out. Thank you very much for coming in to help give us additional information, and I understand that you'll be giving some additional information for the questions that Representative Hansen had. Mr. Attorney General. Thank you. Mr. Young, thank you. We have Sybil Hebb, all right? And then also we would invite Jessica Stevens to come forward. Okay.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I am an attorney and legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, which is a provider statewide of free civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. The Law Center provides assistance in a wide variety of cases, and we determine what sorts of cases we handle based on community priority assessments, and we do an assessment of the community's needs to try to make sure that the services that we're providing are to the people who are the most vulnerable in our communities. And over the years, we have seen an increasing need for assistance to victims of domestic violence and to sexual assault victims. And that's why I'm here today, is to speak to you about the funding from the criminal fines and assessment account that goes to the domestic violence and sexual assault programs and is administered by the Department of Human Services. The Law Center provides a wide variety of legal assistance to victims. Primarily, we assist victims with obtaining protective orders and obtaining safe divorces or separations or visitation orders for their children. Unfortunately, our work seeking legal protection for victims does not help save them entirely. Our work is only a small part of the solution, and that's why I'm here to you today, to speak with you today. When a victim seeks safety from violence, it's essential that there be a coordinated response to the need, to the seeking of help from all parts of the community. Our offices can help to obtain a protection order, but we can't see that it's always enforced. We can't see that the victim is receiving support and other safety services during the legal process. We've learned over the years that this problem is a complex public health and public safety matter, and that it requires a comprehensive set of responses. And a foundational component of our state's response to this issue is the Victim Service Program Network. These programs provide emergency intervention and support services, such as 24-hour hotlines and shelter beds. They also provide individualized safety planning for victims seeking safety, and they provide counseling and support for victims and for their children. Maybe most importantly, advocates at victim services programs help victims to reach out to other community agencies so that they are aware of all of the resources in the community and help them to navigate those sometimes complicated and sometimes scary waters. These are services that provide not only short-term safety on an immediate level, but they provide some hope of achieving safety on the longer term. A victim who is supported by a caring and experienced advocate and who has safe shelter and help in seeking permanent housing, for example, is someone who is better equipped to take all of the dangerous steps and scary steps that are necessary to achieve long-term safety. And this is help that victims seek when they come to us, and it's help that we're just not competent or staffed to provide. We provide legal assistance, but we don't have the expertise and the knowledge and the staff with expertise to provide counseling and emergency hotlines and shelter beds. And those are services that our clients need on a personal level. It's also a service, they're also services that are, that we need our clients to have in order to help our clients. Without that help, our clients are more likely to face trouble in protecting their children. They're more likely to face trouble in maintaining their housing and maintaining their employment. Their legal issues get more complicated. Their legal issues become more overwhelming to them, and they need, they're less likely to be able to follow through on the advice and the assistance that we try to provide for them. So I just want to present to you that these services that go to programs out in the community are a critical component of other system responses as well. And it's a network. So I hope that you, in making your complicated decisions, consider all of the other agencies whose responses are facilitated by the fact that the victim service programs are out there and doing this work on a 24-hour basis. And on behalf of the Law Center, I urge you to support continued funding for those services. I know that there is a very difficult set of decisions in front of you over the next weeks and months, and I hope that in the long run you can consider that wide network in making your decisions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens. I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and we represent caseworkers who are on the front lines in the child welfare system for DHS.
Are you able to kind of respond to this discussion that we were having?
I would love to address that, and I actually would hope that the committee might offer another opportunity, if not in public testimony, but to speak to some of our caseworkers. We had a caseworker scheduled to come this morning, and unfortunately she had to go work with a family this morning, and so was called away, which I'm sure you can understand happens all the time. Specifically, I think you have a lot of difficult decisions to make with limited resources. You saw in the paper the other day where Representative Greenlick presented to a caseworker, you know, how can we best enhance the system? She said we need to protect staffing resources. He says that probably isn't going to happen, so what do we do within the limited resources that are available? And our request would be certainly to not make any deeper cuts at this point. In particular, the legal support would actually create an opportunity for more of that valuable face-to-face time with families. We had some of our caseworkers average up the amount of time that they actually get to spend out of Multnomah County, of some of the Portland area offices, how much face-to-face time they get with children and their families. And on average, it came out to 12%. So that means if a caseworker works 40 hours, less than 5 hours of their week is actually spent in face-to-face time with children and families. And you could ask any caseworker at any day, what is the most valuable use of your time? And that is it. No questions asked. The actual contact that they get to have with the child and their families to make assessments, to reassure children, to reassure foster parents, to be there to figure out what the best resources are that could make sure that this child has a successful, happy, healthy placement or that a family can be reunited. That is the best use of their time and the best use of the state's resources.
So you're saying that 12% of their work week is actually spent face-to-face with people?
That in this, we did a sample for a certain area of the state, and that is what we came up with, yes. So my guess is that it wouldn't vary dramatically in other parts of the state, that there may be a range, but it would be on the very low percent of their time. The other time would be spent in court, preparing for court, doing paperwork that is required not just by the state government and state policies, but also federal law, and important documentation. And then we want to make sure that there's records so that there's accountability so we can track where kids are and what's happening and where their assessments are, and also doing important work networking with all of the different partners in child welfare, including law enforcement. But what I think we all want to do is figure out how can we best support caseworkers so that they can, in fact, spend that quality face-to-face time with families and children. One of the other areas that is truly significant and was a wonderful outcome to the challenges that the system faced, where we came up with the system of care process, and in particular what we call the flex funds. We find those caseworkers found those that money to be the most effective tool in achieving reuniting families or having a child in foster care have a successful experience in foster care. And it is the only tool that a caseworker has where they can specialize and focus a resource directly to the needs of that child or to that family. To make sure that a family can, in a temporary way, be successful, to make sure they can provide support to help parents keep employment or get to a treatment program, or make sure a foster child might have dollars to get their college applications in. Whatever it may be, it can be a very specialized use of those dollars and really the most effective tool at the difference between struggling and getting by and actually achieving success through a family experience. So we really appreciate and see that legislators have recognized the importance of those dollars and have not gone along with the governor's original proposal to cut as many of those funds, but we hope you would re-examine that. And the last part is the staffing crisis that we're in. When you look at 12% of caseworkers' time actually being spent face-to-face, it is not only directly proportional to the amount of paperwork that needs to be done, but also to the caseloads. On average, we hear from our folks they either have anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 times the caseload sizes that they had 6 years ago. And so with the number of cases, obviously, the number of the hours that you can spend on each case decreases. And so the current proposal in even the co-chair's budgets eliminates over 100 frontline positions in child welfare, self-sufficiency, and food stamps. And those are positions that we can't afford to lose if what our goal is child safety and child protection and family protection. So at this point, you know, we're looking for ways to figure out to do the most with the least, to make sure in all of our work that child safety is our number one priority, but the support we need is to not lose more positions, to not go backward in our ability to have that face-to-face time with families, and to make sure that without even enhancing resources, that we protect what we have today so that we have a fighting chance to protect children for the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We have finished the list that we have. Are there those here who are not on the list that would like to testify or speak to the committee? Ed Johnson.
Yes, good morning. My name is Ed Johnston, and today I'm here speaking dealing with foster parents and our system. And I've had many years of experience in this, and the one thing that frustrates me is I keep listening to how we're cutting programs. Well, why don't we cut people's salaries, administration? Let's cut at the top where the money needs to be cut instead of taking away from the kids. The only thing that frustrates me, and I'm going to speak privately on this one, we had a substantial increase of cases from 1997 through 01. It turned out a lot of the substantial increases were because of the school surveys that were applied in the schools, asking parents how many kids about their parents, how many guns they had in their home, all their information about their families and neighbors, and that inspired turned out to be Senate Bill 26 in the 1999 session. That turned to be out the Parents Protection Act bill. That was my bill. That was to protect the parents because when DHS, because of intergovernment agency agreements, and it was proven on the floor that year, that because of intergovernment agency agreements, they were able to take those surveys, and that's how they were saying anonymous callers. And that's how they were going into people's homes, and that was proven. So that's what horrifies me, that the state is using information in the inside of a 12-year-old kid or a 9-year-old kid, and there they sat and testified and said it was accurate. Well, you can't sit there and take a kid who's writing down at 14 years old he's having sex 10 times a week. We all know it's not true. They weren't taking the case, the survey seriously. Kids even testified around the state over it. They were not taking it seriously, and the agency took too much into that account. And what really frustrates me about that whole thing is that that was a way for job security and job creation. But we need job creation. I'd much rather see it in the timbers, the woods, and our fishing industry, and put our salmon back in the system so we have those jobs than the other jobs of coming in and taking our children. Right now I'm dealing, and it's frustrating that if you spank your child in the state of Oregon, you lose your child. Now, I guarantee everybody, every senator and state rep, we've all been spanked. That didn't hurt us. So now we're saying all of a sudden in today's standard, we cannot spank our child. I mean, how bizarre are we going to get that we can't even control our own children? We're saying that the state of Oregon is more responsible. The Lincoln County phone book, which I forgot to bring in with me, which I do have a copy, and there's a few around here. Their definition of parents in their book, and most of the phone books around the state, definition of parents is Services, Children, Family, or DHS. To me, that's a horrifying thing, because the parent is the biological parent or adoptive parent. Not the state of Oregon is not the parent. So when we lose that, we've really lost ourselves by going overboard. The other thing is I would like to ask the DHS to come up with an analyzation of how many parents have been reunited with their children and actually the actual reason why a child was taken. Because I know DHS, and I've been through hundreds of court hearings with DHS. And I've watched DHS workers bluntly lie on the stand. Even where an attorney turns around and tears up the lie, and a judge will go along with DHS, even though it was proven the DHS worker lied. Okay? That is horrifying. I mean, when a judge sits there and allegedly, and I'm going to say allegedly, takes a constitutional oath, he's supposed to base it on the Constitution over statute, not statute first. And so when he's sitting there knowing this and saying the statute applies before the Constitution or family rights, that's horrifying when we're starting to lose that in this state.
Okay, what would you like us to do, Ed?
What I would like us to do is to revisit, not cut any budget. We don't need more attorneys. We need the caseworkers doing their job correctly. We need to make sure that these programs that we're offering out there, that the parents actually did something wrong instead of, and I would like to see a survey done in DHS to determine if the people were convicted of a crime to go through this program, or if they were actually guilty and plea bargained to do the program, and the ones who were innocent to go through the program should be reimbursed for the time lost on job and everything else. The innocent people should be reimbursed instead of justifying other jobs we don't need. That's where I'm coming from. And so that we have a complete statistics on how the foster care program is truly working. Because we know that, you know, there's been cases that have been on the Senate floor where kids have been allegedly sold for up to $40,000-$50,000 through other agencies where they were taken from a kid. And we know that from a situation that happened in Newport where a kid was taken and sold right out of the hospital. So, you know, from a parent, and that's still being fought 5 years later. Okay. But the thing is that we need a direct accountability of this agency doing it, because if they're not doing their job, we don't need the agency, and it is a privilege these people are working. It is not a right that the public gives them a job. It is a right that they're doing to protect us, to work for us, and they need to do a better job than what they're doing right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in today. Are there other... Please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tina Kotek with Children First for Oregon. I'm their policy director. I didn't sign up because I wasn't sure how much time you'd have, so I thought since we have a couple minutes, I just have a few comments. One, thank you for taking public testimony. I think any time you do this, you hear some very interesting on-the-ground stories about how children are being helped through the system. So I think that's very helpful. I want to echo some of the other thank yous that you heard this morning around some of the recommendations in the co-chair budgets around restoring some of the cuts proposed by the governor around special rates foster care, partial restoration around system of care dollars. I would urge that hopefully we can do a full restoration of those flex funds because they are important for the individual child and family. The relatives who take care of needy children, the TANF program, not instituting those income eligibility levels because we want to make sure those children are helped by their families as much as possible. I guess I have just two other comments. That is the linkages between the self-sufficiency and the child welfare programs. You know, if you make cuts on the self-sufficiency side in terms of the jobs program and the retention dollars, which help people stay employed. If you cut those dollars, you might see some repercussions in the child welfare, because we know that unemployment and financial stress on families is an indicator and a leading cause of child abuse and neglect. So I think the connection between domestic violence, self-sufficiency, child welfare, you can't really silo those out. They're all interconnected, and I know you understand that, but I think is an important decision-making part of what you're trying to do is you cut something here, it's going to affect a child somewhere else. So it's really important to keep that in mind. I think the one comment about the staffing study, it would be nice if we had that to understand where we are in caseload and ratios and things like that, because that is a system-wide issue. And I guess I would just take one last opportunity to say, is there information that you need from advocates and other folks to help you make the decision? You're in phase two of the budget process. You're hearing lots of public testimony. You heard some very interesting information around the AG package today. I would just encourage you, reach out to us. Let us know what you need. Do you need to hear different stories? Do you need different numbers? Because we want to make sure you have all the information when you come down to making those final decisions in phase three, or however this is working out through the process. So I know there's plenty of advocates who understand the nuts and bolts of individual programs who'd be happy to do what they can to give you that information. So just let us know, please.
Thank you. The issue on the AG's package, the Attorney General's package, is one that we don't have a lot of first-hand knowledge about, and we don't want to have caseworkers be doing things that are detrimental to the children or their rights or delay things. We also want to make sure that changes that are made in a way that will be most efficient, use money correctly, and be good for the process and the system without just creating more bureaucracy. So that's an area where if I had some additional information, although when I ask for that, what I end up getting, of course, is information from those that have a vested interest in it normally. But
Mr. Chair,
more information in that regard would be useful. Senator Monis Anderson.
Yes. Do we have information regarding the cost of a paralegal versus a case manager? I mean, is there a significant difference between paralegals and case managers' salaries?
I don't think that we do, but...
Mr. Chair, I can get that detail for you. It's in reclass. What's happening in the package is that the positions are being reclassified into paralegals, and I believe there was a little bit of savings as a result of that, but I will double check what those pay ranges are for you and bring that back.
Well, it would be useful if we could get a breakdown on how this is going to work. How many attorneys? Where are they going to be located? Where are the paralegals? I mean, just how is it going to be structured pretty much in three basic offices, and then they're going to do regional? If we could get a written explanation of this, it would help us, I think. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much time do we have this morning to ask questions now?
We have concluded our business.
Let me ask a question.
Certainly.
You're an advocate for Children First. Could you give me your opinion, and this is your opinion, and you're an area, you work in this area, your opinion of the overall system, and here's what my concern is. I come from an anecdotal situation where I have seen families for 25 or 30 years of my practice go through the system. And it's not a major part of my practice, but it's a significant part of my practice. I've seen families with stress and families with difficulties. I've seen abused children. I've had a child in my practice killed through abuse. And I've seen the continuation of this from generation to generation, generation now. I'm now witnessing third generations where the abuse continues. I've seen children grow up who have been abused, and continue to abuse. They are victims of their environment. I've seen families that have abuse where the children have survived and become wonderful parents, too. It's not a simple black and white situation. The question I'm going to here is the question I ask myself, and that is our system really functioning or not? Are we taking children out of families inappropriately and too soon? Are we waiting too long to get children out of families? We know the first two or three years are the most important, and it's really hard to make a judgment that early in a child's life and in a family's history what should be done. And so when we look at the thing we're looking at right now, whether we should put more lawyers into the system at a certain level, that goes to that question. But the bigger question is, do we have a system that is really functioning? Are we really going to deal with neglect and abuse of children with the system we have, or do we need a wholesale change? And that's a very difficult question, which I did not have an answer for. And since we have a few minutes, I'd like to hear your opinion on it.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, that's a big question, and I appreciate that. One of the things we focus on in Children First is the financial stability of families. And when you talk about our system and how it's working, I can't help but go back to where we are in the state in terms of prevention and intervention. And you probably heard, I wasn't here yesterday, but I assume you heard some testimony yesterday around the TANF program. I'll just focus on that one issue if you talk about prevention. That program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, was set up to help families who were in crisis. And right now, that's a system that's not really functioning, because you have to be at a little less than half the poverty level to even be eligible for the program. By the time a family hits 50% of the federal poverty line, they don't have a whole lot of money and they have a whole lot of crisis going on. So the fact that we make it difficult for families to even get into that support system is problematic. Even the department's realizing that. They're looking at right now the overlap between children in child welfare who have come out of the TANF program and have entered the child welfare program, because the number of those cases has been increasing. And they're asking that question, well, if these families have been connected with TANF, why are they ending up in child welfare? And I would argue that that part of the system is so underfunded that families don't get that initial help while they are in crisis to help them be stabilized financially, as well as providing supports for the parents, that things do tend to crash and burn eventually, and those children end up in child welfare and eventually leaving those families. We also hear that families intentionally put their kids in child welfare because there are better supports there than there are in TANF. And that's very disheartening as well, and very troubling. What kind of system is that where family says, I'm going to make that choice to put my child in foster care because I know they'll get more help than I would if they stayed with me in TANF? So that's only one part of the system. I mean, the sad reality is, no matter what you do, there will be a child abused and neglected in this state. we can never have 0%, you know, no child ever harmed, and that's unfortunate. However, I think when we have a system where we don't have enough line workers to get out there originally when the call was made to help those families, when we have a system that doesn't fully fund prevention intervention, you heard from family, you heard a lot from the relief nursery folks, I think, 2 weeks ago when we were talking about the commission budget and the types of services they provide, not only preventing but interventing additional problems in the family. So as you go along the continuum of the system, there are real gaps. And then when a child does enter the system, we're underfunding those families who take care of them. So I think if you look at it as an entire continuum, we do have some serious issues. It's not all resources, but it's really a targeting of resources. You have to go back to self-sufficiency and how are we helping families before things really get bad. And I'm sure there are other people in the room who could probably give other insights. I'm not sure who's still here. I don't know, Philip or anyone, I don't know if you want to open that up for someone else, but those are my just off the top of the head kind of comments about the system. And again, I think the staffing study would be very helpful to get a handle on where we are in terms of case load ratios. I think we have to continue to connect self-sufficiency to child welfare. You can't. It is a continuum. Families come in one end. You don't want them to end up at the other end. And I think your question about the AG representation of how does that help the individual child is the question to ask. We're concerned when we see, yes, the caseworkers will be freed up because of these paralegals, but we're also having less caseworkers because of that package. And from what I understand from talking to the workers, that's a real problem. They not only need more time to be face-to-face, but we need more workers on the front line. So you have hard choices. You know, where in the system do you want to fund? I think adequately funding it along a continuum is probably the best thing to do and figure out where those big gaps are. Maybe that's helpful. I just got back from vacation, so I'm a little jet-lagged.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is there anyone else that would like to? Philip, should I step forward?
Well, Philip's coming up, Mr. Chair. Question is, as we're going through the Department of Justice issue, it was presented to us at one point that this would increase legal coverage from 5% to 15%. And yet I see a lot of paralegals. I can't believe that you'd be hiring that many paralegals for only a 10%. So could somebody find out for me, or if somebody else stumbles on the answer, are the when they say 15%, are they only referring to representation in court by a lawyer, or if you involve the total caseload in terms of doing preparation and stuff, whether that's broader than 15%?
That's also one of the issues that I had is, you know, for this kind of expenditure, we're getting apparently it's just a very little increase. I mean, 85% still don't have the help, and so we're going up a very little.
But on the other hand, if you freed up 20% of the caseworkers' times because legal papers were being prepared and stuff for them, then there might be bigger benefit. Anyway.
Well, that's the issue, because what you have is the current caseworkers are essentially paralegals. I mean, they are doing that work on their own cases, and this is going to move them from those that are doing the work and know the cases to official paralegals who will be getting a file, who won't be familiar with the file, who are going, but will be very used to doing certain things with it. And so, I mean, it's an efficiency fit there as well. We just need more information. Hello there.
Chair Richardson, I'm sorry. I got a lot of things on my mind because I'm really struck by the discussion the committee's having. For the record, I'm Philip Kennedy Wong with EMO Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. Yesterday in my testimony, I felt like I didn't have enough opportunity to comment on some of those self-sufficiency programs that Tina had just mentioned. And I think what we're trying to do, obviously, is when we're looking at the entire system, the people who are in the foster care system are at a step beyond where they want to be, obviously, and there are ways where we can prevent that. And when Tina had brought up, looking at TANF, that's something that, unfortunately, as advocates, there aren't too many of us out there that are advocating for people who are on TANF because there is no institutionalized system that they're connected to where people have a financial interest. I mean, I mean, it's programs like the food bank or EMO that are providing these basic emergency food services, or providing like small cash grants that churches provide when people come knocking on their doors. And unfortunately, there's not enough out there to raise the importance of what the state's role is in all of this, because one of the concerns that we have is that, I mean, we know that you're making difficult decisions, but we also know that there's also a partnership that needs to be kept in place. And that's where the churches and charities are concerned with the state budget, and that is churches and charities don't have the actual capacity to take on additional caseloads, for lack of a better word, when there are programs like TANF that hasn't been adjusted for inflation since 1991. And it's now 2005. So the kind of things that we can do to prevent, you know, children from falling into the foster care system is by looking at some of these self-sufficiency programs like TANF and emergency assistance. I mean, you know, I can tell you
just for a second, because it sounds like what you're saying. I mean, what you're saying sounds great, but it's not. It's not realistic. TANF is a federal program. The federal government is going into huge deficits, and they are not at all considering raising those benefits. And so, where will the churches go when the reality strikes that there is no more money coming in to make that change? I mean, these are real people and real problems, and the soup keeps getting watered. So we're having a little discussion, but I'm just trying to say, you know, you're going in a direction, yes, we need more money, but it's not going to come. I really don't, I mean, maybe you have inside contacts with Washington. But
I mean, obviously, you know, Oregon's TANF waiver unfortunately hasn't been extended by the federal government because they haven't reauthorized TANF. I mean, you're right. I mean, that's a very difficult question. That's a societal question, actually, especially from a religious perspective, in that from our denominations, we believe that we live in a world where there is enough to go around. It's just that the systems that we have in place isn't allowing it to happen. Now, I know there are several legislators, including Senator Westland, who have championed something that we have a very much strong interest in seeing, and that's restructuring our tax system. And that's part of a way of ensuring that we have a much more stable budget environment to ensure that these programs aren't always at risk to the budget acts. And unfortunately, what we're looking at is that we have systems in place where whenever there is a need to cut programs, it always comes out of these self-sufficiency programs. And, you know, for example, emergency assistance was cut in 2003 first it was a long series of cuts from the 2002 special sessions to ultimately its demise in 2003, and now no one even mentions it or forgotten about it, which is unfortunate. It wasn't even a budget item in the governor's recommended budget. And the emergency assistance program is one of those programs that keeps people from becoming homeless. And obviously, when families become homeless, their children become at risk to being part of the foster care system. The same can be said with employment-related daycare. We have a system where, you know, very similar to like the federal, you know, entitlement programs, that we're not reimbursing, say, child care providers at a high enough rate. And what happens is that the differences in terms of the co-pays are born out of the pockets of these families that need to have an employment-related daycare in order to have jobs to provide for their families. And if they're in a situation where they're not able to provide or pay for daycare, they're choosing not to provide daycare, and that means children going unsupervised, and that means they're at risk to unfortunate circumstances. So I understand your question. I'm not trying to, you know, run away from your question. I think it's a deeper question of examining the systems that we have in place, and I think that's where the role of looking at the work that Senator Westland has done in terms of tax reform is one way of, or at least a beginning step, to take a look at how we can create a more stable budget environment.
Chair Richardson, may I follow up on the TANF? You're absolutely right. I mean, we're block-granted from the feds in terms of the pie of what we have to spend. But I think what's really interesting is not to lose institutional memory that over the last couple, over the special sessions, and six or seven of them then, there was savings in the TANF program that was taken to fill budget holes. Money when the economy was good, people were moving off the caseload in TANF, and so we had some money that was on the side, that money went away. Now we're in a difficult situation. We don't have that money anymore. There were some policy choices that were made in terms of the TANF program. We also have dedicated some of our TANF dollars, our maintenance of efforts dollars, to foster care and other things at the other end of the system. I would just encourage us to be honest and say we made policy choices, but maybe we need to revisit those because, as Philip said, those things, the eligibility levels and the cash assistance levels have not been updated since 91. So to say that TANF is functioning is, you know, that's on a real, you know, on a very, very thin thread at this point. And so I think one of the things that the public looks for is, you know, smart, it's the whole accountability issue keeps coming up. And so, you know, we see our numbers go up. We see more kids in foster care. It's like we have to keep the other end of the spectrum, the other end of the continuum in mind and saying we have more kids coming down the other end. It's because we've really, really underfunded the front end. And that's just the reality in Oregon. And the longer-term decisions, I think, Philip, he's correct. And let's just hope we can get out of this session with as little harm as possible to the bare-bones system we have and try to have that significant conversation of how do we build up the programs that help families before they hit such a crisis that their kids have to enter foster care. Thanks.
Well, I can. One. Oh, this is an area I'm sure we could all end up developing comments for hours. Yeah. But if there's the lack of resource issue from the state, another way to look at the problem too is if you look at a family in crisis whose children end up in foster care. If we looked at the total investment that had been made in that family in terms of food stamp, TANF cases, the cost of the case management up until that point, somehow there, you would think there's probably enough money in the system that if we had used it effectively at some point, that we could have avoided the crisis that they're in. But our programs aren't always coordinated, that we have an overload of too many case managers that are working with the same family on different segments of their problems, that somehow I think if there should be some discussion at some point in terms of what would it look if we completely redesign the system and look at all of the resources that are going towards these problems, and are we really directing it to the families that need the most help and at the time when we could be preventing the problems rather than coming in and trying to fix it in the back end. And the other one I don't think we can underestimate is the impact of alcohol and drug abuse all the way through the system on every one of the problems that we end up dealing with.
Absolutely. Senator Westland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and Representative Hansen alluded to it. Philip's comments are certainly germane in terms of there hasn't been any inflation adjustment, and you are absolutely correct when you say that's federal policy, and we have little sway over that. But this is kind of like a sword that cuts both ways with one swipe. I mean, not only do we have a diminishing rate of returns in terms of resource going into the system, but we have families that are more damaged, translate, need more resources, more intensive care because of, in particular, meth and the types of drugs that are out there and available on the street. And it's a push-me-pull-me situation, and I just see us falling further and further behind. I mean, we've got both of those conditions working, and I don't know if Representative Hansen's comment is correct or not. If had we have done more earlier, we'd be better off. I don't know how we could have done that in a state, you know, whose revenues fell further and faster than any other state in the nation, save Alaska. I mean, it's just fiscal reality. But this is a tsunami, and we're just waiting on the beach, waiting for it to crash.
I can reply quickly. I don't mean in terms of, you know, are there different programs that we could have in place, or could we have done different things over the last 2 or 3 years? I'm talking about if we were refocusing the whole system in terms of a lot more emphasis on prevention on drug and alcohol issues before people even have kids, just a real broad look, not specific in terms of what have we or haven't we done over the last couple bienniums, but what would a real good comprehensive system based on prevention look like instead of the problems we're dealing with now?
Mr. Chair, having worked most of my professional life with at-risk families, I think we have to also remember there is a continuum. And there are some families that we're trying to help, but they're not going to change their behaviors. But there are, and that's what motivated me to keep in the profession that I was, is there are some families that truly benefit from programs, and there isn't one program. We need a variety of different systems helping these families, because there are families that do want to better themselves. And so I think we have to remember there are going to be a number of families that we want to help and we want them to change, but for some reason or another they've chosen the lifestyle or their way of life, and so our services may not help them, but I think on the most part we have to keep doing what we're doing, because there are very many, many families that can benefit from the services that we provide. But the meth problem is, I think, just the killer in our society right now.
Yeah, it's a wild card because it changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the fact that Philip's here, but I want to remind you, I mean, you represent the Ecumenical Ministries, right? Christian-based.
Yes,
so
fair.
But you're here to say we need to restructure the tax structure so that there could be more public funds to help raise programs, and yet the voters in Measure 28 and Measure 30 have indicated they're not real interested in paying more taxes, even when they were told that there would be tremendous cuts. And so as you go back, I mean, I was asked about this previously, and my response was, and I would ask you to not necessarily respond in this venue, but I'll just mention to you, where in the New Testament did Jesus ever say, give more money to Rome so that Rome could take care of the poor? And the reason I bring it up is, we've got this system that is, it's in turmoil. And the solution from people in the building are, we need more tax money so that there's more money to throw into the programs, into the pool, so that we can give more benefits. But in reality, the people are saying, and this is all across the country, we're not going to continue to move toward the shift towards socialistic approach where you have a redistribution of wealth, that enough is enough. And this is what we're being told over and over again by the voters. And in my district, they're saying it loud and clear. And yet in this panel, we see there's a tremendous need for caring for the least successful or the most needy in our society. And so as we go through this turmoil of watering the soup every 2 years, you know, I mean, we're just putting more water into it and we're cutting more people off and we're saying, well, we're not going to give an increase into foster parents, or we're going to take relatives off of providing care, and all we're doing is cutting benefits because we have $1 billion more than we had before, but the current service level to retain programs at the level they have been in the past is much more than that. And so every 2 years, we keep trying to make the continuation of a system that is not functioning well. And the system is actually broken, and yet we don't have the ability in this building so far to have a long-term plan to change things in the way that we deliver services. And so it ultimately appears to me that more and more responsibility will have to be borne by local communities, charitable, philanthropic, service-oriented organizations, because they will not allow the people to continue to suffer as government programs keep cutting back and cutting back. So I'm, you know, just in saying that this is what...
I want to make a response to that.
Senator Bates.
Your particular community has given you that message. My community has given me a very different message. And the parts of the state, surprisingly, that are flourishing the most, those parts of the states that voted for and supported ballot Measure 30, whether it be Ashland or Eugene or the Portland area, is the areas that have the highest income, highest education in our state. They are the areas that produce the most income, that subsidize the rest of the parts of the state that need the services the most. Our real problem in this country, I think, is this divide we have in our population, in which
There's one group that says, we don't want government. We don't want to pay for the government things that are happening. And yet those are the very population, generally speaking, that are using the most of these funds. And the parts of our state that are saying we are willing to pay for those in a reasonable fashion, if they're used well, are the ones still voting for the ballot measure 30s. And they're being outvoted by narrow margins across the state. It's a very strange situation. The point that I think you and I both agree on is I have real concerns about the system we have in place. I think the system we have in place is underfunded, absolutely. Is it the system we need to have? I'm not so certain. And that's where you run into the problem. How much money do you put into a system that you're not having complete confidence in at all levels? I have absolute confidence in people like Mary. Absolute confidence. Others, I'm not so sure about. We asked for a staffing study at the beginning of the session, and we did not get it. And that's the kind of thing that just gives me real serious heartburn.
Politics at the price of people. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard a disc jockey on the radio last week that said, why don't those people in Salem just do what the voters wanted and get done and get out of there? Well, I think probably, Chair Richardson, your voters may have wanted you to do something different than what my voters or Senator Bates has wanted us to do. And then this is very facetious, but I did hear that there's a rumor that last couple months, Jesus re-registered as a Democrat.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, if I may, I mean, respond to your comments, because I think, you know, you and I have had this conversation earlier, you know, during a session, and I mean, without having a theological debate, because I'm not a theologian, I'm a lay person. But with all due respect, I think what we're looking at is not necessarily more taxes per se, but a system that uses the taxes and for what services. And that is really, I think, the key for us, is that we look at taxes as a means, not the ends. And unfortunately, I think in our state and in this country, people see taxes unto itself as evil. But I think ultimately, I think when you ask people, you know, what we should use taxes for, I think a lot of them will agree that the programs that the state funds are programs that the citizens want. It's not always pretty. It doesn't always come out in the way that people would like it to become. But I think as legislators, I mean, we believe that there is an opportunity for lawmakers to take a look at our system in which we have, you know, three tax brackets, right, 5%, 7%, and 9%. And the highest tax bracket, 9%, starts at $6,675 of taxable income. And it's the same tax bracket as, say, Phil Knight. And I think that is an inherent flaw within our system that we can at least take a look at. It's not necessarily that, yes, I mean, the question, I mean, the point you raised that, you know, middle to lower income Oregonians are disproportionately taxed, especially on the property tax and spectrum, because that's probably the most regressive form of taxation. And that's something that we have worked to try to relieve the property tax burden. But one thing that low-income tax filers don't have, the upper-income tax filers have, are all the deductions, you know, from their capital or from businesses they own, and other things like mortgages, so on and so forth. And so there is a reason why, you know, people from rural parts of the state who are generally low-income are opposed to taxation. And that's really because it's the system that we have in place, and that's probably why, and I'm guessing, why they're why they oppose measures 28 and 20, I mean, and 30, because let me share with you one story that I heard. I was watching television, and it was around, I think, one of the ballot measures, I think either 28 or 30, and they're interviewing a parent for, I believe it was a Hillsborough school that they're interviewing, because I think Hillsborough was a school that was looking at 17 school days being lopped off of their school year. And they asked the parent, you know, are you going to vote for this tax measure? And the parent said, well, I've got other bills right now. I got to pay for food and heat. And between the extra $78 or $80 I have to pay and the 17 school days, unfortunately, I have to pick, you know, paying for the groceries and the heating, because that's a much more of a critical immediate need. I mean, and they were, I mean, that parent was very supportive of having 17 additional school days, but they're having to triage you know, their decision making, which is why ultimately they ended up voting against that tax or against their long-term self-interest. I think that's the dynamic that Oregonians are in, and not necessarily anti-tax for the sake of anti-tax, just that because we do have, unfortunately, you know, I was looking at some statistics on poverty level yesterday, and there's a lot of people in the state of Oregon that aren't, you know, getting by. And, I mean, it's no wonder why they're opposed to taxation, but I think as lawmakers, you have the power, the authority, and the ability to do something about it in terms of our tax structure. I mean, we've applauded the work that that you know, like Representative Max Williams and Lane Cheddarly has done, Senator Westland, in terms of forcing that debate that we need to have as a state. I mean, I would suspect that, you know, just because there's opposition by voters to certain ballot measures, it has never, at least in my observation, ever stopped lawmakers from pushing bills that voters have either, you know, voted against or like supported. That, unfortunately, that's not always a sound way of making decisions.
Okay, thank you.
You know what that sounds like to me, Mr. Chair?
Senator West.
That sounds to me like we need to come up with a tax reform proposal that reduces income taxes for all brackets, 15 to 150 plus, and produces additional revenue for the state. Gee, does anyone know of a proposal like that?
Can we do that from the floor of the DHS Revenue Committee that we're just setting up here? Is that what's happening?
Anyway, thank you all. It's
thank
been
you
a very interesting conversation. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being a part of this. This is your government. We're trying to work through very difficult challenges. Those of you that testified today, we appreciate your input, and especially we appreciate the service, the quiet hours, weeks, years of service that you give to help your neighbors in need, and especially helping the children. So we thank you very much. With that, we're adjourned.